All right, so Ed, first of all, thank you very much for doing this. It's an honour for us. So just to give you a bit of an idea of Ed's influence, you've written 3 books, the latest one being Into the Heart of Mindfulness. We can talk a little bit more about that later. Former editor of FHM, a magazine that was very prolific in my college and my high school, my secondary school.
Deputy editor.
Wrote the Be Mindful report for the Mental Health Foundation. Now, this is important because this spearheaded a campaign to bring mindfulness training into the NHS. Co-teacher on the Foundation's Be Mindful Online training course, and also an advisor to and former co-director of the Mindfulness Initiative. Now, this group supports the all-party parliamentary group on mindfulness, which develops mindfulness-based policies for the UK. So before we go into your introduction, I thought perhaps if we could begin with this, because this is a really interesting point for us. This parliamentary party, so it produced the report, and just to quote, it's the first legal document in the Western world to focus on how meditation might be valuable in key policy areas such as education, criminal justice, and it's the first time that mindfulness has been seriously considered by modern Western government as a basis for national policy. So can you just share with us a bit of like how, your involvement in that and maybe some of the latest on that?
I think it is very significant what the British government has been doing in the Houses of Parliament. It's, as you say, it's the first Western government to take mindfulness seriously. And I think to put it into context, when I started practicing meditation about 15 years ago, the idea that politicians in the House of Commons would be meditating together, and not only that, but working together to consider how meditation-based practices and approaches might actually have a role to play in public policy would have been cloud cuckoo land, really.
Yeah.
Meditation and mindfulness were so kind of out of the radar. They would have been considered so alternative, perhaps a bit wacky.
Hippie.
Yeah, hippie, new age, whatever the, you know, all of the phrases that used to come up, still do sometimes.
Yeah, still do, yeah.
It's an enormous change, and I'm actually, I still find myself somewhat staggered by the speed of that change. Really, the driver of this has actually been Chris Ruane, who was a Labour MP up until the last election. And it was really his vision that he saw the potential for mindfulness meditation through his own experience, both in terms of helping his fellow MPs and politicians in working with the stresses of their lives and jobs, but also the wider vision of how this might pan out in wider society. So it was really, really Chris. And I remember I met Chris a few years ago before the all-party parliamentary group had formed. And he told me about his vision. And we met because I'd co-written a book called The Mindful Manifesto, which touched on the possibility for mindfulness in politics. But Chris had really thought about this, and not only that, he had the he was in a position where he could actually put this into action. So it was his vision and his energy. He invited all his fellow MPs to learn about mindfulness. He arranged for teachers from the Oxford Mindfulness Centre to come and introduce mindfulness to MPs. So the MPs began, and members of the House of Lords began with their own practice. They came and took a mindfulness course, led by the teachers at the Oxford Mindfulness
Centre. The traditional 8-week course?
Yes, it was an 8-week course.
Was it a more diluted one?
It was an 8-week course, okay. I believe. And that was the foundation. And that was very skillful of of Chris and his colleagues to do that, because really it's very difficult. It would be very difficult to try to see how mindfulness might be valuable in all of these wider areas without first engaging with the practice. Yeah. So from there, from that course, there was an impetus to then begin to take this further. And so many of the politicians gathered together and decided that an all-party parliamentary group on mindfulness would be a good next step. At the same time, supporting this were Chris Cullerton and Madeleine Bunting, who had got together to form the Mindfulness Initiative, to try to support this movement within Parliament and the all-party parliamentary group. And Madeleine called me and asked if I wanted to get involved. So it was interesting because my meeting with Chris Rowan a few years earlier had happened separately to that, and then Madeleine invited me to come and help run the Mindfulness Initiative, which then led to the development of the Mindful Nation UK report, which the various associates of the initiative, about 20 people involved in mindfulness in various different fields, came together to help produce the report with the APPG, and that was then launched last October. So it's been the kind of kernel of this was Chris's vision, I would say, and then the power of mindfulness practice, actually, when people sample this for themselves and taste it for themselves, often they will then become inspired to take it further. And I think that's what happened with the politicians. And so the Mindful Nation UK report was born from that personal experience.
Because when we try and tell our friends about what mindfulness is, you know, we still have a challenge because, you know, it's very much you need to know your audience because there are an infinite ways, I guess, you can describe mindfulness. But to have it in Parliament and have people trying it, have members of Parliament trying it out, and not only trying it out, but having it then lead to other projects and to other initiatives, it's very promising, and it demonstrates that this is, like you said, it's no longer a hippie cause. It's now very much backed by science, and it's, you know, people are discovering that a lot of the root problems in our society, you know, they're not all going to be eroded by mindfulness, but, you know, we can begin to look at tackling some of those through mindfulness.
Well, all of the difficulties and challenges that we face as human society come from our very being human, from our minds and bodies.
Yeah.
And of course, mindfulness training helps us to work with those challenges and difficulties. Yeah. It helps us to see what they are, to become familiar with our minds and bodies and how they work and how sometimes they might lead us astray.
Yeah.
And so it has a relevance, therefore, to every part of our lives, because we bring our minds and our bodies to everything that we do and everything that we are, and all of our relationships and our work and our obviously our caring for our health and our schools and so on. So when you actually consider what mindfulness is, it then starts to make sense that training our minds and bodies to work skillfully with the world, actually it makes sense. Yeah. But I think you also touched on something that's very important, which is that it's very difficult to describe what mindfulness is until you've experienced it, because it can't be captured in words. Words can point to what mindfulness
is. It's the experience itself, isn't it?
That's right. It has to be experienced, because words can only give you an abstract or a conceptual indicator, but without the experience itself of actually learning, I can look at my mind and body and I can relate with it in a way that is perhaps different from the usual conceptual mind that we learn to bring to our experience, and perhaps we become accustomed to bringing to our lives. We can come down into a different space with mindfulness, but it's a space where words are somehow inadequate to describe.
Yeah.
Well, one of your previous definitions of it, I want to see if it still holds true today. You said, I've been experimenting with an adaptation. So mindfulness as the awareness and approach to life that arises from paying attention on purpose, fully present with curiosity and compassion.
Yeah, that's the working definition that I tend to start with. When I'm asked about what mindfulness is, draws heavily from Jon Kabat-Zinn's definition. It's probably noticed it's very similar to the way he describes it. I added in the approach to life part there, because I think there can sometimes be a misconception about mindfulness that somehow it can be passive, or that it doesn't have a connection to how we live our lives. And actually, my view is that mindfulness is a way of actually seeing what brings well-being for ourselves and for others and the world around us. So inevitably that is related to how we live. Mm-hmm. So it's not just about kind of sitting still, you know, more the ideas about meditation. Mm-hmm. It's about seeing what's within so that we can live our lives skillfully. So I just feel it's important that approach to life aspect is perhaps emphasized, because sometimes that is misunderstood or left out.
Yeah.
I was going to say in complete agreement, because it goes beyond just the formal practice of meditation, doesn't it? It is, I mean, approach to life is a fantastic definition to throw in there, you know, addition to the traditional definitions of mindfulness and how it's, yes, one sits there and does the formal practice, but there's a payoff, I think, as well, in how you experience the rest of your life. So you've got the 15, 20 minutes daily practice.
Yeah.
But it is, I mean, it's just a complete shift in your perspective because of that relationship with the self and then your thoughts and everything. So I think that is a real core element and tied in with its traditions, as of, you know, with the Buddhist tradition. I mean, although in the 21st century it's not a practice that's necessarily a part of Buddhism, but I think that there was traditionally a relationship with a philosophy of life. So, and how that can shape, the practice can shape your perspective and philosophy on things.
Yeah. Well, learning how our minds and bodies work in meditation practice is the ground of then taking what we've learned out into the world.
Yes.
If we were practicing meditation just to become good meditators, then what would be the point? Meditation is a practice that enables us to see what's going on, so that we can bring what we find out into the world. Now that sometimes means that it is good for us to spend some time in practice where we are in a contained space. And I think it's important that the formal practice of mindfulness meditation, I think that's a key part. And, you know, it's a bit like if you learn to play the piano, you've got to spend some time practicing your scales, you know, and actually learning the skill of practicing the piano so that you can play.
Yeah.
And it's the same with the mind. It's important to have some time where you're dedicating yourself to looking at and working with the mind, but that's not, you know, that's not the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's practicing that so that we can continue to practice it when we come out of formal meditation practice and into our lives.
It's like a martial art, you know. You learn the katas and the techniques so that when you do need it, when there is a confrontation with someone, you're now in a position where you've got the muscles and you've got the techniques, then you're better at dealing in that situation.
Right, that's it. And like any skill, any skill can be honed and developed and cultivated, and meditation is the training in the skill of working with the mind, and then we can take that mind and body. I mean, we can take that mind and body out, and when circumstances are difficult, we're perhaps more likely to be able to manage those difficulties with more skill.
Yeah.
I also like the compassion element of it as well. You know, the idea that you you know, you do this practice, which is sort of, I suppose, done in solitude. You know, it's you and your own mind, and yet that extends to your relationship with others. You know, so if we want to build a better society, if we can train school children and adults and the workplace, that if the practice of mindfulness can help increase one's compassion towards others, then that is a benefit. You know, for all. And I think the enthusiasm that is why it's been so successful, not necessarily just because there's the scientific evidence. I think in the 21st century that's very important for us to, I think that's why we were so enthusiastic at the start, that we felt, okay, we're going to do something that's been backed up, the importance of science. But yeah, just the compassion element, I think it's a win-win, you know. So not only do you feel that in difficult times you've got something, you've got a tool that can now help you, you know, it's not going to alleviate, you know, we haven't got the panacea, as I keep saying, we haven't got the solution to all problems, but at least there's this really, really powerful tool that, you know, can help you cope with things. But at the same time, knowing that going out there and sharing this idea would help others to be nicer, kinder to each other. And I think that's the essence of the message of Action for Happiness as well. And that's why mindfulness has been such an important part in their message.
And compassion is inherent in the very practice of meditation, when we bring our minds back gently to whatever it is that we're paying attention to.
Yes.
So there's a kind of a compassion right there in the kind of basic meditation instruction. When the mind wanders away, we acknowledge that, we accept the wandering of the mind as a normal part of human experience, and we invite our minds back to the object of mindfulness with kindness. And that, it's kind of like there's a sort of maybe an attentional muscle that's trained there in the coming back, but there's also a kindness muscle that's being trained there, in that sense of that we kind of are learning how to relate to our experience in a gentle way. And it seems to be that when we train in that this compassion naturally expands out.
And
there's a fascinating piece of research that came out a couple of years ago where a group of people trained in they went through a mindfulness course, it was found that when they were invited, when they were presented with someone who was suffering, and were given the opportunity to either ignore them or give them a seat. It was someone with a broken leg, supposedly. And it was found that people who'd taken the mindfulness course were several times more likely than people who hadn't taken the mindfulness course to spontaneously offer this person in distress their seat. And that's without any explicit compassion training in the course. And just from that implicit training in kindness to ourselves seems to extend outwards. And of course, because we are all influencing one another and influenced by one another, there is a kind of a as you say, it's a win-win. Because if there is more compassion in the world, then we benefit, and if we can offer more compassion to the world, then the world benefits.
Yes. Actually, end your book on kindness and talking about compassion. I guess is that the natural evolution, I guess, on this journey? They say when you master anything like a martial art or something, that the immediate reaction is that you want to share it and you want to help other people.
Yeah, and I think that comes from, at least in my my own experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, I came to meditation, mindfulness practice, because I was in distress. I was anxious and depressed, and I was desperate for ways to alleviate my own distress. So, you know, that motivation was very definitely about me. Mm-hmm. And yet, gradually over time with practice, as you say, you start to see, you see that me focus, mm-hmm. And actually recognize that maybe that me focus itself is part of the cause of that, exactly, yeah. the cause of that, yeah. or some of that distress.
Yeah.
And by being able to unhook attention, to unhook the attachment that we have to our own thoughts and our own impulses and desires and so on, actually we discover there's some space around
yes.
that. Mm-hmm. And that in itself actually makes us feel better.
Yeah.
So ironically, the way you know, although it's completely normal and good that you know, we look for ways to alleviate our distress when we're in distress,
mm-hmm.
Actually discovering that in the long run, it's a kind of opening out and a letting go of that,
mm-hmm.
that sort of self preoccupied
mm-hmm.
focus that really brings a deeper happiness.
Yeah.
So John Kabat-Zinn, you know, a fantastic quote that he said to us on our podcast was that mindfulness has it's an amazing revealing quality. So can you explain to us on your mindfulness journey, you know, that yes, there is the practice, you sit down and then you start to feel, then science shows that it helps, you know, improve your immune system, lowers blood pressure and all that stuff. But there's growth as well in the understanding and how deep it can get. So Pat, can you share with us some of the lessons that you've learned along the way and perhaps some of the paradigm shifting moments of clarity that have kind of, you know, really advanced your
yeah.
learning?
Yeah, there've been a number of moments that I can reflect back on as being significant, it seems. I mean, I think probably the first important moment for me was recognizing that it was possible not to be completely tied up in my preoccupations of mind, particularly, and my
yeah.
My anxiety and my depression. As I say, when I came to meditation, I was anxious and depressed and very much in my head,
yeah.
and trying to get away from the distress that I was feeling, and that wasn't working very well because, of course, the distress I was feeling was in me. So I was running away from me. And what meditation practice showed me was that actually, just possibly, the way to work with this was not to try to fight what was happening to me or run away from it, but actually to be present to it with gentleness. So when I discovered it was possible to watch what was happening in my mind without being completely caught up in it, which came to me really quite early on in meditation practice, although it was just fleeting moments to begin with, that gave me the belief that more might be possible.
Mm.
So there was something right at the beginning which, hang on a minute, this is interesting.
Yeah.
There's something here that I hadn't
yeah.
seen.
Yeah.
I can actually observe my experience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think this is actually before I even learned to meditate. I remember a psychotherapist saying to me, you know, can you observe your experience? And I was like, can I what?
Yeah.
I don't know what you mean.
Yeah.
And then I tried it.
Mm.
And I was like, wow, I can start to actually look at myself, even, you know, look at myself in pain,
mm-hmm.
And realizing that therefore there must be a part of what I am that is witnessing and not caught up in pain.
Yeah.
And that was like, wow, well, this
yeah.
is very interesting. And then through
separate, almost a little bit of separation from the thoughts.
That's yeah. right. A little bit of space, a little yeah. bit of separation. Okay, space, yeah. yeah. And so that came more and more in those early days of meditation. And then after I'd been practicing for a few months, my depression and anxiety lifted. Mm. And so I that kind of encouraged me more.
Yeah.
And then I would say probably a year or two later, I went on a month's retreat where I was practicing every day for around about 12 hours a day for 28 days.
Wow.
And that really was it wasn't a mind-blowing experience, it was a mind-showing experience. because it for the first time really, my mind and body were still enough to really see that, you know, maybe not just a little bit of separation but possible, but actually the world is amazing. And you know, I could see things with a richness and a connection to the beauty of what is around in the world that I'd just not experienced before, or at least couldn't remember ever experiencing before. And I remember being just absolutely so moved just by this experience. Yeah, of course, you know, I wasn't actually, I was just staying in a tent in a field and yeah. with a group of people also meditating.
But our perspective has shifted to yes. I think that's so encouraging, isn't it? Especially if someone is suffering from depression, which we know is very common across the
very
age
common,
groups.
Yeah.
And to hear, you know, you describe it in such, you know, passionate terms and how your relationship to the world profoundly changed because
yeah.
of this practice, you know, what hope that offers really. Because
yeah.
I think when you go through depression, I suppose, you see a sense that, a sense of hopelessness. And, and you know, when you mention ultimately, maybe people look for the causes outside of themselves, when in fact, possibly, that you're running, you know, that trying to escape yourself is not possible unless there is some change internally, I suppose, and some action.
Well, you know what? I'm not sure it's change internally, in so much as actually an acceptance of what's
yes.
internally, because actually, my and I think it's important to emphasize as well that in those experiences, that wasn't the end of my experiences of anxiety and depression. I did have kind of relapses, if you like, into
yeah.
anxiety and depression as I was learning meditation,
mm.
and I still experience times of
yeah.
of difficulty.
Yeah.
I no longer use the word depression to describe it because that no longer feels
mm-hmm.
kind of truthful for me.
Yeah.
But difficulty and physical sensations of that I were used to call anxiety and depression.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that I no longer resist those in the same way,
mm.
and my relationship to those experiences are different from what they used to be, thanks to the training and support that I've had from the various people that have taught me meditation. And in the sort of my first. After my first sort of year or two of meditation practice and mindfulness practice, I went into it very intensively, and they were wonderful experiences, but it wasn't really enabling me to integrate into the world.
Yeah.
And so I definitely felt that experience of not being able to talk to people about what I was noticing,
mm-hmm.
And being frustrated that people might not be interested in it, or that the world didn't seem to be interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
I feel very fortunate now that you know, in the years since then, mindfulness has become so
yeah.
so mainstream. You
yeah.
know, it suddenly is possible actually to live in this world. And
what year did you start writing and getting into mindfulness? Because I was when I researched the stuff, I went, wow, you know, you were ahead of the game. You were writing about this stuff from years ago.
Well, nowhere near as far back as some people, but I mean, I started work. I mean, the first piece of mindfulness-related writing that I did was for the Mental Health Foundation in 2010. It was published, which was the
Be Mindful. 6 years ago. That's, I mean, because everyone seems to be jumping on now in the last year or two onto this bandwagon. But you know, to have been living this life, you know, from 5-6 years ago. That's...
Well, I felt it. I you know, I did feel that. I mean, I was looking for ways to kind of make this integration from what I'd found. Because after my going on retreat, I then went to live at a retreat center for a year. Mm. But I didn't particularly, it didn't seem to be my path to, for example, go and become a Buddhist monk or to go and spend the whole of my life in one of those settings. I was drawn back to kind of mainstream world. And so I was looking for ways that, how can I take this, how can I bring this really important, not just an aspect of my life, but you know, the whole of what I've now discovered about living. Mm. You know, how can I make that how can I, you know, pay the bills while living in congruence with that? And so I feel very fortunate that the Mental Health Foundation is just at the time when perhaps mindfulness was beginning to kind of bubble mm-hmm. In the NHS, and so you know the possibility of actually writing a report that was designed to put the case for mindfulness training in the NHS was possible, and funding was found for that. So that was kind of the start of the road of writing about mindfulness for me, which then led me into not long after that training to teach mindfulness. So I've been very fortunate in being able to integrate this, which probably wouldn't have been possible in the same way 10, mm. 20 years ago. Yeah. At the same time, I think the practice has helped to kind of enable me to become more grounded in the you know, the day-to-day world of bringing up a family and living in the world that we live in, which is important because, you know, if this practice is to be a benefit to a wider world, mm-hmm. then we need ways to connect with that world, and that's the real genius, I think, of the work that Jon Kabat-Zinn has done and those who have continued in that path of bringing mindfulness into the mainstream, is to make something which is very difficult to explain and used to be seen as alternative, to present it in such a way as that people can really connect with it and therefore connect with themselves and the world around them. Yeah. Our task is to I think sharing experience is so helpful. Yeah. You know, actually sort of hearing stories of how it's helped is just as important as the all of the research which is being so brilliantly brilliantly done by the scientists. Yeah. Hearing experience can really kind of tune people into to maybe what they might be looking for.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
You're welcome.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You. Thank you.
Great to meet you.
That was awesome.
Yeah, really enjoyed it.
It's getting hot. We got the projector on.
Really hot.